I'm now joined by Bassam Haddad, who's director of the Middle East Studies program at George Mason University and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He serves as founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal and is co-producer director of the award-winning documentary film About Baghdad and director of a film series on Arabs and terrorism. His latest book on Syria's political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. And Bassam Haddad recently directed a new film series on Arab Muslim immigrants in Europe titled The Other Threat. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for having me.
And do you think that that the situation in Syria is somewhat poised either for a major conflagration or for a, in effect, a victory on the part of the regime in terms of crushing the revolt, and then that would sort of lead to a kind of seething, wounded populace, and I guess inevitably another round sometime later. So if that's correct, where do we stand?
The first thing about Syria that I think it's good to keep in mind is that there's very little credible information that's coming out. So it is best to stick to what we can confirm and corroborate with in terms of various sources basically claiming the same thing and documenting it. What we have in Syria today seems to be a government's determination to crush the protests by force. Somewhere, somehow, a decision has been made that to hold back now would be political suicide, and not to move forward would be irrational given the rising death toll. We are at anywhere between 500 and 800 dead, depending on the source that you cite. We have, it turns out, more than several thousand people detained and locked up, and thousands of injured. So we are in a situation where we passed the point of no return in terms of a reconciliation that would bring back peace to Syria. What we might have is something that is a settling of accounts by force and a kind of stability that can only be maintained by force, which might very well, as you suggested, erupt in the future. And that is the best-case scenario for the regime. Of course, the other scenarios we've seen elsewhere, we have the Egypt or Tunisia model, whereby there will be some sort of compromise. This is not very likely, considering that the regime in Syria is not likely to split up at the very top. It's more like a struggle until the end. And then we have the Libya model, which is basically that. It's a struggle until the end, except that in Libya we do not find as much grassroots support of the regime. Not that the regime has majority support, but it does have considerably more support than Gaddafi did in Libya. So we might not see the kind of bifurcation that we are seeing in Libya. Between just the regime and its money and its fighters and everyone else. So we might have a third option that is likely to be a little bit more messy, a little bit more protracted, and perhaps something that will not even bring about a definitive resolution or end. And beyond that, it's very difficult to sort of prognosticate. It's actually more important to try to, as much as possible, to stick to the facts. The facts on the ground show that the Syrian regime has already surrounded three cities, well, two vigorously. The third is Homs. The first two are Banyas and Dar'a. Dar'a has been cut off, in southern Syria, has been cut off from the rest of the population and is surrounded and has been invaded internally. With dire conditions developing, a similar situation, and though not as severe, is developing in Banyas, the northern coastal city of 50,000. And then Homs, the third city in Syria, is under a similar threat at this point. And it seems that this is a model that Dara'a in the south has been a model that the regime is replicating.
Well, given your book, Bassam Haddad, The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria, it would seem to me that this is a sort of mafia family regime, and the brother Maher, who's just been sanctioned by the U.S. And by the European Union, he's the head of the presidential guard. There was some, obviously, the older brother who was killed in a car accident was supposed to take over, and a lot of people thought that the ophthalmologist from London was a little on the weak side, and he's gotten this reputation, which seems to be wholly unjustified, as a reformer and a tech-savvy guy who wants to bring Syria into the West, and that all seems to have been a mythology on the part of the regime. But what do you know about this sort of mafia family and the role of the brother Maher and possibly the sister Bushra?
Information about these things is precisely what we all should stay away from. I mean, people discuss it all the time, and that's fine.
Sure.
But most of the discussions are actually meaningless because they are always repudiated or debunked by other information coming from a similar political position.
Right.
I'm not saying that they're debunked by the regime. They're debunked by people like you and me who basically get other information or somehow have access to other information. We really do not know that much about what's happening on the inside. The Syrian top leadership is notorious, or the top leadership in Syria, and stories about the top leadership in Syria are just notorious, and people have come to take them with lots of salt to the point where, it's more misleading to focus on them. We do not know what's happening. We know that there was early on some sort of confusion in terms of how to respond during the first week. Beyond the first week, we do not see this confusion. If anyone tells you, more information than that, then I'm not sure what they're basing it on.
Well,
now, and as far as my book, I mean, my book is not about the Syrian regime being a mafia or anything of the sort. The book is about how in developing countries, state business relations develop informal networks that end up actually benefiting from economic change disproportionately. And of course, there are degrees. Some countries benefit more than in some countries, these networks benefit more than in others. And it has to do with the kinds of checks that are placed on them. So in Syria and Egypt and Tunisia, these networks actually benefit tremendously. Those networks in some other countries benefit somewhat less. In some sub-Saharan African countries, they benefit somewhat more. In the United States, they benefit quite a bit, but there are checks and balances placed on them. So these networks exist in all political economies, and it's a matter of how much these folks can get away with.
Well, I think what we do know, and your point is well taken, Bassam Haddad, that first of all, there's no Western press allowed in, and apparently there's been these rumors forever, about the family, and it does obviously to some extent operate on a patronage system, but what we do know, I think, is some of the external players. So we know that the neighbors to the north, the Turks, are concerned about instability. We know that Israel has actually paradoxically seems to have settled on having a predictable enemy. And the reports that I hear from Israel are that they don't think things are going to go the way of the revolution because there's not enough support for the revolution in within the population, which is something I'd like to ask you further about. And then we know that John Kerry tried to sort of woo the regime and the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it had notions of bringing Syria in from the cold. So what's your sense of what we've been up to? It doesn't seem to have worked, and perhaps we haven't really known what we're doing.
In terms of the Syrian situation? Or
yes. Yeah, in terms of the idea that somehow we could woo Syria back into the fold.
In terms of the Syrian situation, the American administration has started out somewhat defensive about Bashar Assad, saying that he is a reformer. as time went by, they basically retracted the strong supportive language, but they have not replaced it with anything that smacks of the opposite. What we have done, what the United States has done, is sanction some individuals around the president without sanctioning the president, which is a signal that if things change, we are willing to create some sort of a deal. Now, it also is a way to maintain leverage. If you sanction everyone in Syria, including the president, you basically lose leverage, given that there are no relations between the states and Syria to speak of, on which the United States can bank on. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, trying to woo Syria away from the resistance axis, which includes countries, non-state actors, and perhaps a good deal, if not the majority of the Arab population that is in this resistance axis that rejects the apartheid state of Israel as it stands and rejects America's double standards in the Middle East, I think that's not going to work, especially at a point when Syria is fighting on the regime, at least, is fighting on the premise that it is fighting external factors and actors that want its demise, and is banking on the fact that it has some nationalist credentials. Now, the fact that Syria is exaggerating these credentials in light of its own brutal violence against its own citizens is, of course, obvious. Nonetheless, structurally speaking, the Syrian regime does play a role that is bigger than itself in the region, and is not exhausted by the regime's own actions, because it is a symbol of resistance for many actors in the region, and that is a point that one can dismiss from a pure ideological standpoint, because the Syrian regime is killing their own people. But from a structural, geostrategic standpoint, you cannot dismiss it, because even if the Syrian regime is being duplicitous, the people and actors and states that consider Syria an ally are still allies of Syria, and still, act the same way and have the same preferences based on Syria's position. So in that sense, it's not likely that the United States will move Syria away from its position vis-a-vis Iran or Hezbollah. However, we may all be surprised.
Well, just in closing, then, Bassam Haddad, just to address the ambivalence that the neighbors have, and frankly, the U.S. seems to somewhat ambivalent about what to do, and perhaps there's not much they can do. But what I read in the Israeli press is that they don't think that there's sufficient unrest and support for the revolution, that the Assad clan have it pretty much under control, and the notion of Western politicians on the road to Damascus. I don't know whether you remember back in the days of Clinton how many visits Warren Christopher had with the father, Hafez al-Assad. I mean, it was unbelievable. So it seems like for the longest time we really haven't really had a handle on what we're doing, and we've constantly tried to woo Syria without any with scant results.
Do you want me to comment?
I know I'm making it confusing for you, but let's comment on the reports from Israel saying that there isn't sufficient support inside the country itself for any kind of revolution.
Well, inside Syria, I mean, it's a very complex situation, in the sense that for the most part, people would like to see a more democratic regime. However, the complexity is not in the optimal preference of people. The complexity is that this optimal preference is very difficult to achieve without the journey or without venturing into the unknown in terms of what is likely to come next, how is it likely to come about, and whether a war close to Libya will take place or something that will invite external interference will take place, as in Iraq. And Syrians are very scarred by what has happened next door in Iraq, at least psychologically. So there is a good deal of the Syrian population that is still not, that has not taken to the streets, not because of support for the regime and not because of, you know, simple hatred of the regime. I mean, they would rather have a change, but because they value the kind of social peace that existed in relation to what might come next, not in the absolute sense. And it's very difficult to understand that sometimes, or even prove it without a lot of corroboration or without a lot of deep and historical knowledge of the, of Syrian society based on field work and research. But the reality is that what explains what we see today in Syria, which is basically that we're not seeing, you know, 8 or 10 million people on the streets like we are seeing in Yemen or like we saw in Egypt, although Yemen is more comparable population-wise. And that's precisely because people are concerned about the possibility of sectarian strife or chaos and so on and so forth. But I think as violence increases, we are seeing, and we will be seeing, more and more people take to the streets. How the regime pushes in the next week or two will determine the extent to which more and more people will abandon this preference of stability and join the protesters.
And in doing so, it requires a kind of courage that, frankly, I don't think we here in the United States would have. You know, to go out on the streets and face a little tear gas from the police is one thing, but to face bullets from snipers and cannons from tanks is another.
It absolutely is. It's very different. Yes, and you know, people will do that, as we have seen in Tunisia and Egypt. People will do that when they feel that they're. I mean, human beings are rational, and as much as the American popular media and parts of academia and government would like us to believe, Arabs are also rational, and they calculate. And this calculation in Syria on part of a good deal of the of society yields that if we go to the street at this point, it's not going to get us what it got the Tunisians and Egyptians. And I'm speculating as well. I mean, this may be changing as we speak, but there is a reason why we don't see millions of people on the streets. And it doesn't have to do with the fear of reprisal, but it's not just fear of reprisal that is at stake. It's also a calculation of, even if the protesters have their way, what kind of vacuum will emerge and who will fill it and how will people's lives be affected in the immediate to medium future.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking with Bassam Haddad, who's director of the Middle East Studies Program at George Mason University and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He serves as founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal and is a co-producer director of the award-winning documentary film about Baghdad and director of a film series on Arabs and terrorism. His latest book on Syria's political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. And Bassam Haddad recently directed a new film series on Arab Muslim immigrants in Europe titled The Other Threat. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report.